My name is Joe Jordan. I'm from Santa Cruz, California. That's where I live, and I work over the hill from there at the north end of the Silicon Valley at NASA Ames Research Center. In case you didn't know, NASA has a bunch of centers. There's Johnson's Space Flight Center in Houston, Cape Kennedy down in Florida, Lewis Research Center near Cleveland, Langley, Virginia, and a whole bunch of them. But the Ames Research Center mostly does a lot of wind tunnel research on experimental aircraft and a lot of heavy supercomputer simulations of galaxies and evolution and the way the atmosphere works, and that's the part that I'm involved with. They also have a couple of high-flying airplanes that are very useful for experimental studies of the atmosphere, and we've done a couple of missions to the polar regions of the Earth in the last few years. I'll show you a couple of videos from those, probing this ozone problem in particular. Before we get too far into anything, why don't I ask you a few questions just to give me a sense of how much you folks already know, and also sort of as a bit of a preview for you of what we can talk about in the upcoming hour. First of all, how many here know the chemical formula for ozone? How many know what ozone is made of? Okay, I guess we got about 40 people, maybe 5 or 6 raised their hands. And another question, how many people know what halons are and what they're used for? We're down to about 2, 3, 4. And does it ring a bell with anybody when I say UV, A, B, and C? Does that make sense to anybody? A few more people there. Okay. Well, let's see. I'll give you the quick outline here. I guess, and tell me if there's anything else that you'd like to have covered in the talk. It seems to make sense that we ought to start off just saying, well, what is this stuff that all the fuss is about? And what's happening to it? What are the chemicals and processes that are involved in its destruction? And why, in particular, is it happening most dramatically at the poles? You might wonder. That seems to be kind of far from where the action is as far as the release of chemicals. Another question, by the way, we might ask about what is ozone is where does it come from? How's it made? Where is it found? Why is there an ozone layer in the atmosphere at all? And, up there in the stratosphere. And on the other hand, what's all this stuff you hear about ground level smog ozone? So what's happening to it and how? What are the causes of the damage to it? And then what difference does it make to us? Why worry about losing it? What's it good for? And finally, what can we do about it? So I guess might as well just run by you right now the gist of it all, get it out of our system. I'm sure most of you have probably read about it in the media. The basic idea is that ozone is something up there in the stratosphere, wherever that is, which screens out the sun's harmful ultraviolet radiation, which if it weren't screened out would cause all kinds of medical problems. I guess the most famous one that you're probably familiar with is skin cancer. There are a lot of other effects both on us and on the ecosystem and even on the structure of the atmosphere potentially. And the thing that's destroying the ozone and thus threatening to let in lots more ultraviolet radiation is these artificial chemicals that are used in industry and the home. Chlorofluorocarbons, halons, and a couple of others which we can go over. So that's the gist of the whole talk, so if you want more details, well, stick around. The key to this whole thing is light. I mean, that's our whole problem. There's nothing particular about ozone that we especially love. In fact, it's really pretty nasty stuff. We don't want it down here. That's why you have smog alerts in cities, and you're not supposed to go outside too much or run around very much if there's a lot of ozone, because it tears up your lungs and it's hell on paint jobs and tires and things like that too. So there's nothing we especially love about ozone. The thing that's important to us about it is its effect on light, and then light has an effect, a lot of effects on life. So we might as well begin at the beginning, let there be light, talk about light a little bit. And I guess to talk about light, we should talk a little bit about space and waves. A meter is about this big, about a little over 3 feet long, and 1/10 billionth of a meter, much too small to see, is called an angstrom. And the symbol for angstrom is one of these little Norwegian letters. I guess it's Norwegian. When we were in Norway, I saw a lot of those. They pronounce it oh. And so one angstrom is about 10 of these, 10 of them minus 10 meters. And this angstrom is the unit that they commonly use to express the wavelengths of light. Now here's a little crude illustration of just the concept of wavelength. Here's a long wavelength and here's a shorter wavelength. And there's actually a little bit more to this diagram than that. Red light actually does come in longer wavelengths than blue light, so that part's accurate there. There isn't any one unique wavelength for red light or for blue light. There's whole gradations of hues in the spectrum, but the red light is typically at wavelengths around 7,000 angstroms, and the purple light is typically at wavelengths around 4,000 angstroms. These are on the order of half a micron, half of a millionth of a meter. Now, there's another thing you should know about the energy of this kind of radiation, because it's the energy which is what kills things. The long waves have lower energy than the short waves. And just an intuitive, sort of playful way to remember that is to think of sort of long, laid-back, lazy, cool waves versus agitated, kinked-up, short, energetic waves. So, now, light is a pretty strange stuff. It seems to act like waves, but it also, when you look at it in other ways, it seems to act like particles or photons. And waves and particles are supposed to be mutually exclusive kinds of things, and that's the whole quantum mystery, which we could go into sometime out under the stars, maybe. But basically, what it all is electromagnetic radiation. And what that is very rapidly traveling, wiggling fields of a couple of electromagnetic fields. And the electromagnetic radiation is generated by extremely rapid vibrations of charged particles in some light source, such as the sun or a light bulb. And as you know, heat and temperature have to do with random jigglings of the particles, the molecules and atoms that make things up. The hotter something is, the faster its particles are jiggling around, and in particular, the faster its charged particles are jiggling around, and these are going to generate much more rapidly wiggling waves, such as the higher energy blue and purple light. So the energy of the light depends on the energy and temperature and what generates it. Now light comes in a whole variety. Well, first of all, let me say, if I'm losing anybody at any point, or if you're confused about something, or just have a question, make sure to chime in and nail me on it, make sure I get it straight. So most of the wavelengths of light, electromagnetic radiation, are invisible to us. I mean, light is really a very general term. The visible light is a very narrow range. This isn't drawn to scale at all. It's actually a lot narrower than what I've drawn here. But you get the red as the long wave, low energy light, and the purple as the short wave, high energy light. Just beyond the red, you get into the infrared, and infrared is the radiation that is emitted by things that aren't quite red hot, such as our bodies. You know, we're at 100 degrees Fahrenheit, that's pretty warm. If we turned off all the lights and the sun was out, we wouldn't see each other at all with our eyes. But if we brought an infrared camera in here, which, you know, can sense infrared, we'd all be blazing with infrared light. The light we see each other with now is light that came from things that were hot enough to generate, you know, green light and blue light and yellow light. Those are very hot things. And, you know, the color of our skin and flesh color is, depending on what, you know, it's some kind of a mixture of the various colors. But these are all visible colors which were generated by something very hot, either a light source or the sun. We're just reflecting and scattering that light. But we actually emit infrared light. And the tables and the walls and the chairs are doing the same thing. Dogs and cats can see in the infrared, and it would be kind of interesting if we could. It's sort of fun to imagine what it would be like if we could. It would be a whole new color. What would it look like? The infrared is important in the talk I'll be giving in a couple days on the greenhouse effect, because that's the kind of radiation which is trapped in the lower atmosphere and threatens to warm up the earth substantially and cause all kinds of problems. And that problem, now that's something I should point out right now, is a lot of people confuse the ozone hole and the greenhouse effect, and they think that they're the same thing. They're really literally at opposite ends of the spectrum. The greenhouse effect deals with this infrared radiation. The ozone hole deals with the ultraviolet, which I'm going to get to in a second. And when you get to longer waves than infrared, you get to millimeter waves and microwaves and radio frequency waves, which are miles long. On the other end of the spectrum over here, you get just beyond the violet, and you get beyond the range where our eyes can see, you start to get into the invisible ultraviolet. And when I said UV A, B, and C, that was referring to this stuff here. Just as with the regular visible colors, there's a whole set of wavelengths for ultraviolet, sort of grading from the lower energy, longer wavelengths, UVA, into shorter wavelengths, even higher energy UVB, and then the really high energy UVC. And bees can see pretty well into the ultraviolet, and that's one of the problems with the ozone depletion. If we let too much ultraviolet in, well, it's not just going to be the skin off our backs with skin cancer and cataracts in our eyes and damage to our immune systems, but bees, if they get too much ultraviolet, they'll go blind, and they're very important in pollinating a lot of the plants, which we depend upon for food. So that's just one of the things kind of important to the whole food chain. Now, beyond the ultraviolet, you get into X-rays and then gamma rays, kind of the highest energy class of radiation. That comes from the annihilation of matter and antimatter, among other things, which is the most efficient energy source known. It's where you completely convert mass to energy. We'll be talking about that in the talk on astronomy a couple days from now, and also, again, out of the star at various times, if you get me started. Now, let's talk a little bit more about this, because this is where this whole thing is going to be centering. UVA is sort of the friendly ultraviolet. You know, you get a little bit of it, you get a tan, and feel pretty good. If you get too much of it, you get a bit of a sunburn. And now you get these even shorter wavelength UVB. And a little of that's not too bad, but most of that we want to stay away from. That's the stuff that will give you skin cancer in any significant quantities, and it'll damage your eyes. The UVC, that's the stuff that never reaches the earth. And it's a good thing, because that would fry us in a minute. Now, the thing is, the UVC doesn't reach the Earth's surface because not of ozone, but because of oxygen, just regular old O2, the oxygen we're breathing. That's sort of a little known fact. I guess you hear all the fuss about ozone and not oxygen. I mean, ozone's what protects us from the UVB. See, the two forms of oxygen, I should tell you right now, ozone is O3. It's a molecule of three atoms of oxygen instead of the two, which is in the normal oxygen, three. O3 protects us from this. The O2 protects us from a slightly different band of the ultraviolet. And the reason you don't hear much about that is that we're not in any danger of losing our oxygen yet, anyway. But the O3, the ozone, we are in danger of losing that, and it performs a special function that isn't performed by the regular oxygen, so we need that stuff to protect us from the UVB. Let's see. Any questions at this point? Okay, I guess I'll take this one down, see if the scheme works here.
All right.
Okay, now, don't get scared with all this chemistry up here, but this is just... You know, let's talk about how do these things protect us from ultraviolet anyway. Pretty simple idea, really. First of all, does anybody know what the word ozone means? Where it comes from? I mean, I've written it right up here. It comes from a Greek word meaning... means to smell. And you can actually smell ozone, you know, around an electric train set or after a thunderstorm or near high voltage power transformers. Electricity can ionize the air and is one way you can make ozone, but we're more concerned about the way you make ozone using light from the sun. See, ozone is both created and destroyed by ultraviolet light from the sun, and there's a continual sort of dynamic equilibrium up there in the atmosphere where it's just being created and destroyed all the time, and it's kept in kind of a nice balance until you start throwing like things like chlorine and bromine in there from these artificial compounds, which we'll talk about later. Those really throw a monkey wrench into the picture. But let's look at the nice natural chemistry for a moment here. Now we've got to switch also from the wave picture of light to the particle picture of light, the photon picture. That's a good way to look at this. Here's a way the oxygen protects us from that really hot, hard, ultraviolet UVC radiation. The oxygen is up there in the atmosphere, and a hard photon of really energetic ultraviolet comes in, splits it into two single oxygen atoms. And so that saves us from that photon. The photon that would have cooked us splits up this oxygen molecule instead. So that's the gist of that idea. Now, then you get recombination happening all the time. You get these singletons floating around, but there's also plenty more of these O2s, and they join up and they form back into ozone. So in a way, it's created ozone there by destroying the oxygen. But it also can destroy, now this, I've drawn this actually to be a little bit less big of a, this nu, the Greek letter nu stands for frequency, which is kind of the inverse of the wavelength. Frequency is directly proportional to energy. Something that's more wiggly and more kinked up is a more frequently vibrating wave. So this one isn't quite as high a frequency as this one. It takes more energy to break an oxygen molecule, a diatomic oxygen molecule. That's why the UVC, the harder radiation, is necessary to break up the oxygen molecule. You don't need quite as much energy to break up the ozone. That's why it shields us from the slightly less energetic UVB. So anyway, though, it'll do it. This is quite an unstable molecule relative to the O2, which is quite stable. So you don't need as much energy to break it, but you do need the energy of a UVB photon to break it, and then you get a regular diatomic oxygen and a singleton. And then you can get these things combining. The ozone and a single will give you two oxygen molecules back. I should point out that the atmosphere as it is right now, with all the oxygen in it, I mean, it's about 80% nitrogen now, and most of the rest is, a good bit of the rest is oxygen. But the modern atmosphere wasn't this way before life evolved on the Earth. There was plenty of oxygen around. It came just with the astrophysical origin of the Earth, but it was all tied up in the oceans and in rocks and chemicals and compounds and things like that. Wasn't until life came around that we got the oxygen, the diatomic oxygen that's in the atmosphere. Now, there was a certain trick that life learned which gave us the oxygen. Does anybody know what that is?
Photosynthesis.
Yeah, photosynthesis. Now, the thing is, down in the oceans, you get a little bit of protection from the water, from this ultraviolet radiation. So life was able to, you know, molecules were able to organize themselves into something complex enough to perform living-type functions. That happened in the ocean. But you can only get single-celled organisms until you really start building up a good bit of oxygen in the atmosphere to screen out some of that hardest ultraviolet radiation. Then you actually began to be able to get multicelled organisms and life on dry land. And once you got more life on dry land and more plants and things, you got even more oxygen in the atmosphere. So the oxygen was built up by the life that's there. And if we lose the ozone, then we're probably going to lose quite a bit of the life, because the ozone screens out some of the ultraviolet. So let's see. Oh, by the way, something that you might not know is that if we could just purge all the chlorine and the bromine, and these chemicals in the atmosphere which are screwing up the natural chemistry of the ozone, it would only take about 3 to 5 years for the sun's ultraviolet radiation to remake all the ozone we need to restore the atmosphere to normal levels. But that's an impossible if, at least as far as we know. There's no way to purge the chlorine and the bromine from the atmosphere. Stuff goes up there, it takes about 15 or 20 years to get up there from when it's released at the ground, stays up there for 100, 150 years, and it's just in the pipeline. You know, the stuff that we've seen so far happening is just the leading edge of the problem. We've got another, the last 10 or 20 years worth of releases haven't even had their effect yet, and they won't for another few years.
Are they not destroyed in the process?
Are what not?
Chlorine and bromine.
Ah, well, that's, let's see, that's the next slide, actually. They're catalytically destroyed and then regenerated. Each atom of chlorine can destroy about 100,000 molecules of ozone before it finally finishes its life in the atmosphere. I guess we might as well go ahead and go right into that a little bit here. Oh, well, let me point out a couple other things about the ozone at the ground level. That stuff is generated by fossil fuel burning, especially in cars, and smog. The main component of urban smog is ozone. And a lot of people ask the question, well, heck, we got too much ozone down here and not enough ozone up there. Why don't we pump it up there? But something you need to know is that even the very most harmful concentrations down at ground level are only about a 30th or a 100th of the needed concentrations at the stratospheric level. In other words, you get about 0.3 parts per million on the smoggiest days in LA, and your typical natural level in the stratosphere is about 10 parts per million. So if you took that ozone from the ground and pumped it up the stratosphere, all you'd be doing is diluting the stratospheric ozone. Not to mention all the energy costs and everything else it would take to do it. So that scheme just won't work. And well, you may have heard something about some people did some measurements of ultraviolet actually reaching the ground, and they said, gosh, you know, what's all the fuss about? There's actually less ultraviolet reaching the ground, not more. Well, it turns out their monitoring systems were set up near cities where there was a lot of smog at the ground level, and smog has ozone and it will screen out ultraviolet. But more accurate measurements since then have shown that we are indeed worldwide receiving quite a bit more ultraviolet, and it's going to get worse before it gets better.
And none of that has anything to do with the greenhouse effect?
No.
Or does it?
No. The greenhouse effect is where you're putting other gases in the atmosphere, carbon dioxide, methane, nitrous oxide, and chlorofluorocarbons. That's the one connection. The chlorofluorocarbons, which destroy ozone, also are very effective greenhouse gases. Okay. But the greenhouse effect is where you are heating up the troposphere, the lower layer of the atmosphere, by trapping infrared radiation. The ozone problem is where you're letting through too much ultraviolet because you've destroyed ozone. So, let's get rid of this thing. Now we get to even, you know, you might hate chemistry, but this is an example of chemistry that hates you back. So anyway, here's the basic idea. Let me just rush through this. Here's an atom of chlorine. And these atoms get broken off. Well, you send these chlorofluorocarbons or other chemicals up into the atmosphere, and they are shielded from the harmful ultraviolet rays of the sun, just like we and everything else down here, by that ozone up there. But these chemicals are very inert. They just don't react with anything. And they float around, and they eventually make their way up above the ozone layer, to where now they're not protected from ultraviolet. And the ultraviolet comes in and breaks off the chlorine spot. So one way or another, you get three atoms of chlorine. These things just rampage around through the ozone. Here's a basic process. Chlorine will react with an ozone and give you chlorine monoxide and regular old good old oxygen. Then you get chlorine monoxide. This chlorine monoxide here will run into a singleton, single oxygen atom, regenerate the chlorine atom, and give you some more good old regular oxygen. So essentially here you're actually destroying two ozones. You're destroying this one and the one which would have been made by combining this with some O2 someplace. So you've lost the chance for two ozones there, and you've regenerated your chlorine to start the process all over again. So that's a catalytic chain reaction. And this was actually predicted back in 74 by a couple of scientists, Roland and Molina, and they were laughed out of the ballpark, and everybody thought it was science fiction, and doomsayers saying the sky is falling. Well, these guys were more right than anybody could have believed. I think they're definitely up for a Nobel Prize at some point. Thing is, it actually has gotten worse than they predicted. They were basically arguing sort of this mechanism, but there are even more vicious cycles which operate at the poles in particular. And that's why, whereas worldwide we've lost maybe 5 or 6% of the ozone, which is a lot, at the poles, for several months out of the year, we lose up to 90% of the ozone. And it's lucky that it's at the poles where there isn't a whole lot of life, and it's also lucky that it happens mostly in the late winter and early spring when the sun's not too high down there anyway. But the big question is it going to spread, and you know, how much worse is it going to get? And really, the thing that affects us is the worldwide trend. Now, here's something that can bottle this mechanism up, and it normally it plays an important part. You get these reservoir species of chlorine that tie up the chlorine. Hydrochloric acid, this is not anything to do with acid rain. Acid rain is mostly sulfuric acid. So this is good stuff as far as we're concerned. And then chlorine nitrate here. You get nitrogen dioxide from the atmosphere's abundant nitrogen, and it'll interact with these chlorine monoxides and bottle it up in this chlorine nitrate, which is a very stable species. And methane, which can actually also play, well, it's one of the greenhouse gases, and it can in other ways aggravate the ozone problem too, but here it's playing a good role. It'll tie up the chlorine and hydrochloric acid and also give a methyl radical there. So that's a process which sort of is competing with this and kind of keeping it in check. But then, starting in 1985, a guy and his team down there in the Antarctic, they were doing these, faithfully chugging along for years and years, doing these balloon surveys of the stratosphere over the Antarctic, and
they were always having to argue for funding, and people were saying, why do you keep doing this? You know, who's interested in this? Finally, he started noticing a precipitous drop in the ozone over the South Pole, over large areas, like bigger than the United States. And first year he looked at it and checked and rechecked the data. He couldn't believe it. He said, well, how come nobody, you know, the American satellites, how come they haven't picked it up? How come nobody else is reporting it? So he went and got some different equipment and moved it to a different place the next year, and it was even worse. And but he still was just afraid to say anything because there must be something wrong and nobody else is talking about it, and we do have the satellites up there. The third year he saw it and it was worse yet. Finally he had to say something and everybody looked at it and they laughed him out of the ballpark, but it turns out he was right. And the American people, they went back and looked at their satellite data, and sure enough, on the raw tapes, there it was. But it's just that the programs that had been processing the tapes routinely and displaying the data and all this had code in them which filtered out any such absurd values as this, as they were getting. In other words, the drop was just too ridiculous to be real. And the program was written to screen that out and just consider it as anomalous, invalid data. It turns out the raw data, though, it was there and it was real. It's just that nobody... Anyway, what I'm saying is over the poles, there's a special process that goes on, which really makes this happen in a big way. I mean, you might wonder, we're releasing the things here and in the industrialized world. They float up into the stratosphere, and then they take, you know, 50, 100 years to kind of disperse all throughout the atmosphere, all over the place, so they get over the poles. And then it's so cold over the poles that you get certain special kinds of clouds in the stratosphere where you don't normally get clouds. I mean, we're talking 10 or 15 miles high. And the clouds you see around here or any place else, even the highest wispy cirrus stratus clouds like we've been having today, those are up around 25,000 feet, 5 or 6 miles. But over the poles, you can get these polar stratospheric clouds, and you'll see a couple pictures of those on the videos. They're very beautiful clouds. They're called mother of pearl or nacreous clouds. Maybe some of you have been to Norway or Sweden or Scandinavia. They see them up there quite a bit from the ground, too. These clouds provide ice crystal surfaces which catalyze special reactions that just don't proceed very fast in the gaseous phase. But when you have a gas interacting with a solid crystal, that's called a heterogeneous reaction. It's different gas and solid interacting together. This speeds the reaction up a whole lot. And that's why things are happening so much worse at the poles. I'll just run through real quick. Get these two nice friendly reservoir species here. What happens on the crystals of these polar stratospheric clouds, they interact to give you chlorine gas and nitric acid. And then you can also interact this same thing with water in some of these clouds, and you get this hypochlorous acid and nitric acid. The Cl2 and the Cl, these can both be broken off as soon as the sun comes up. These reactions here happen in the nighttime, in the late winter, before the sun is up over the pole. And then as soon as the sun comes up, it hits this stuff, splits off the chlorines, and then you get this process going. And you get a couple of other processes going, too. Just run through this real fast. The really vicious one is where you get two chlorine monoxides, and you get what's called the dimer reaction. You get this thing here, and then this will be split up by light. You get a free chlorine in that, and then this thing will break down into another free chlorine and oxygen. These free chlorines just go rampaging around through the ozone by this same process I showed you up here. All the things I've talked about with chlorine are even more virulent with bromine. Fortunately, there's not as much of bromine in the atmosphere. The bromine is what comes from the halons. The halons are the chemicals that are used in fire extinguishers mostly, also some fumigants and untold military applications. But the chlorine is the biggest element in all this chemistry, and it comes from, we're almost there actually, it comes from all these CFCs that we'll talk about. Before I get on to that, let me just point out there are a couple of twin reactions, one with chlorine and one with bromine, that give you chlorine monoxide and bromine monoxide, and then those mixed together and give you a free chlorine and free bromine to start all over again, and sort of a double whammy catalytic chain. And let's see, where do the chlorine and bromine come from? Well, first of all, before I go on, does anybody have any questions or comments about any of the stuff before?
I have a question. What's the effect on the poles of having big poles in the ozone?
Well, one of the effects that's really important would be the plankton. It's unknown, though. there are some studies being done right now. There's a lot of desperate effort to try to figure out just what the effect on the plankton is going to be. Because remember I said earlier that life in the ocean can hide a little bit by going down underneath the water that screens out some of the ultraviolet, but and under the ice. But they just don't know how effective that response is going to be, how much it's going to have to bend its lifestyle out of shape, you know, and adapt. And is that what you're asking, that kind of thing? I've heard some stories about some polar expeditions recently where people took all the normal precautions and, you know, went across the South Pole or something, or went across the North Pole pack ice, and they came back with tremendous burns and paint peeled off of their, you know, the pigment totally destroyed in their clothing. And this has just been in the last few years. And in Tasmania, which is way down there, you know, near New Zealand, Australia, the skin cancer has doubled in the last 10 years. That's a pretty dramatic statistic. There's also a big rise in skin cancer in this country. However, you can't blame all that necessarily on ozone, because there's also a big movement of the populace towards the south and a big change in lifestyles towards a lot more lying out in the sun. So it's a little hard to filter out those effects. Tasmania, I don't think people lie out in the sun a whole lot more than they used to. Who knows? Anyway, let's talk about the chemicals here. The culprits. Boy, now here's some chemistry for you. It's kind of a fun little game we can play here, though. These are the famous chlorofluorocarbons. What time is it getting to be here? I gotta make sure I don't die. 4:30? All right. Gotta allow, when it gets to be 10:00, I gotta show you these videos. So the yellow one's about 15:00. I think we're on schedule. These are the names of these things. These are the two most commonly used ones. These numbers here, this is an arcane numbering system that the chemists came up with. The ones place digit is the number of fluorines in the molecule. The tens place digit is one more than the number of hydrogens in the molecule. And the hundreds place digit is one less than the number of carbons in the molecule. So let's just see if we can verify that here. Okay, we got one fluorine, we got no hydrogen, so you add one, yep, sure enough. And we got one carbon, you subtract one, and there's a zero there. Okay, and just try with this one here. We got two carbons, you subtract, don't have any hydrogen, so you add one, you get that one, and we got three fluorines, so sure enough, there. And here's one that actually has a hydrogen in it, and so you add one to that, and that's where you get that two. Funny thing is, chlorine is the thing that we're really concerned about, and there's nothing in this number system that has anything to do with chlorine. But it's important to note this hydrogen in here. This is an HCFC, and these are the chemicals which are being considered as possible substitutes for the CFCs. They still destroy some ozone, but not nearly as rapidly or as effectively, and the reason is because of that hydrogen in there, which helps this molecule break down before it gets into the atmosphere. I mean, up into the stratosphere and into the ozone layer in particular. See, that's the problem, is these things don't break down until they're way up there and then start coming back down through the ozone layer. The chlorine breaks off, and then that comes back down through the ozone layer. But this hydrogen just makes this whole molecule more reactive, so it'll break down into various pieces before it even gets up through the stratosphere. Trouble about these things is these are also very effective greenhouse gases, just like all these chlorofluorocarbons. In fact, about half as much of the greenhouse effect, which again we'll talk about on Wednesday, you've heard about carbon dioxide, I'm sure, about half as big an effect as that played by carbon dioxide is contributed by the chlorofluorocarbons. And each molecule per month, for molecule, the chlorofluorocarbon molecules are about 10,000 times as effective as a carbon dioxide molecule in trapping infrared radiation. Partly this is because the carbon dioxide has kind of trapped all the infrared it's going to trap. It's almost saturated its band of the infrared spectrum that it deals with, whereas the chlorofluorocarbons, they're dealing in a slightly different band of the infrared, and there's not nearly as much of them in the atmosphere yet, so they're far from saturation. So as you add more, they have much more of an effect per molecule. But anyway, let's see. So these two here are the ones that were used in styrofoam a lot, and actually they still are, but not in food packaging. Most food packaging now no longer uses these things in styrofoam. But insulation and packaging material you got to check. It's still used quite a bit. And the soft foam, the polyurethane, foam rubber, that uses this stuff a lot. These are also used in air conditioning and refrigeration. This is in refrigerators and car air conditioners. This is in home air conditioners now quite a bit, and so is this. This one here is the fastest growing of all the chlorofluorocarbons. Anybody know where it's used? It's in the computer industry. It's the solvent, the cleaning solvent for computer chips. There's been quite a bit of progress made on that recently. I don't know if you read, IBM just came up with a whole new, basically a high-tech dishwasher, hot deionized soap and water for cleaning its chips. And I just found out to my dismay that at NASA Ames Research Center, they take barrels full of this stuff and slosh it on the walls of these giant wind tunnels just to degrease them. So I'm heading up a little committee down there to get on their case about that. I mean, if IBM can clean its intricate little computer chips with hot water, then NASA can certainly use something different than this stuff to clean its wind tunnel walls. But anyway, the stuff is just very volatile. And a lot of companies have made big strides just by cleaning up their act, literally. There was one that, you know, this is such a good solvent, and it's, you know, these are such wonderful chemicals. They're non-toxic, non-flammable, non-carcinogenic, non-reactive, and they're so volatile and such a good cleanser, though, that the people at this one company were literally washing their dishes in just big open vats of this stuff. And, of course, it's just evaporating like mad into the atmosphere. So they've cut down 80% on their use of it just by capturing it with hoods and recycling it, and that's the kind of thing that's going to have to happen. I mean, the stuff is on the way out now. There's been this Montreal Protocol, which really didn't do a whole lot because we didn't even understand the problem yet when it was negotiated. That calls for a 50% cutback by the industrialized countries by the year 2000. However, there are so many exemptions and exceptions that it's really only going to lead to about a 35% cutback. And anyway, though, this week they're having a meeting in London. I'll be interested to see whatever papers float up the lake to see what they come up with. I think they're going to be calling for banning most of these chemicals by the year 2000, and that's just about what we need. Let's see, well, what was I going to say? Something about, yeah, they also came up with some substitutes for this stuff based on orange peels, something called BioAct. It's a spray that uses the terpenes from orange peels. Trouble is they discovered that that tends to be slightly explosive, though, when you spray it, so. And there are problems with some of these substitutes. But I mean, we have, you know, we have all this technological ingenuity. We need to really be rapidly pursuing substitutes and find out whether they're safe and find out what their effects are on the atmosphere. The halons, as I said, are in fire extinguishers. They have a similar kind of numbering system. These are the ones that involve bromine. And they have been increasing, the bromine's been increasing the atmosphere by about 25% a year, which is a lot. Fortunately, it's not very much yet. We're at the parts per trillion level, but it's fast. Some of these are also regulated by the Montreal Protocol. Now, here are a couple chemicals which aren't regulated by the Montreal Protocol, and I'm hoping and praying that they will be considered, and I think they will be, in this meeting that's happening in London this week. This is methyl chloroform, which has three chlorines per molecule there, and this is kind of the most potent of any molecule. It's got four chlorines per molecule. It's carbon tetrachloride. They're both industrial solvents, and this stuff is actually one of the ingredients in your typewriter whiteout correction fluid. So these are very important to get under control. This stuff is increasing by about 1% a year now, and this stuff, methyl chloroform, is increasing by about 7% a year. And again, it has a hydrogen in it, so it's not quite as bad on the ozone because it tends to break down before it gets up there. But it's increasing at 7% a year, and just by getting rid of this stuff alone, you could make the most rapid positive impact on the ozone problem because it has such a short lifetime in the atmosphere. That means that as soon as you get rid of its source, you'll see effects pretty soon thereafter. The problem with all these is that because they have lifetimes of 100, 150 years in the atmosphere, even if we stop making them right now, stop sending them up there, well, the stuff that's already on its way up there from the last 15 or 20 years is going to continue floating around and diffusing and blowing around up there. and it's going to do its damage for the next 100 years or so. We won't see the effects of the regulations that are happening now for a long time. So that's all the more reason to get going as soon as we can.
Yeah. Who produces these things, and how important are these to their overall profitability?
That last question is really good. DuPont is the world's biggest manufacturer of chlorofluorocarbons. They did, by the way, forswear them. They said, okay, we're going to stop making them. They wouldn't announce a timetable, but now they have. They're going to shoot for the year 2000. Thing is, you know, they, as well as Allied Signal and a whole bunch of other companies that are major manufacturers, just fought tooth and nail all along, you know, ever since the first theoretical predictions to where we finally discovered chlorine up in the atmosphere and finally pinned the chlorine to these things. And, you know, they kept saying, oh, there's chlorine all the time going up there in volcanoes, and, you know, it's been happening for years and years. But it turns out that, you know, we're putting five times as much chlorine in the atmosphere now as any natural sources. And that's the level right now, and it's threatening to go up, you know, three or four times that in the next couple of decades. But anyway, so these guys really did a snow job for a long time until I guess they finally realized, well, it's their own children and their grandchildren too, so they better get with it and stop making this stuff. But here's the really stunning statistic. The CFCs were 3% of DuPont's revenues or profits, or I forget. It's 3% of their business. So, you know, I don't see why it was such a... Now, the thing is, you can understand the European countries that are making some of those companies over there are much more specialized in dealing just exclusively in that. So they actually have been having a harder time getting their companies under control than we have with DuPont. I mean, DuPont can do other things. But for a long time, the Europeans were the real hard ones to get. You know, remember in 1978, the Americans actually did ban CFCs from spray cans. Couldn't get the Europeans to go along with that. As far as I know, right now, the only countries that are not doing that are the Scandinavians and us in Canada. Well, hopefully this will all change with whatever happens in London this week. I think we're getting pretty close to video time here.
Yeah. So what happens, how do you finally get rid of the chlorine and the bromine atoms? Apparently after 100 years or whatever, they disappear.
Yeah, that's a good question. What will happen typically is chlorine will finally get rained out in hydrochloric acid. Again, that's not acid rain, but it'll just eventually bump into a hydrogen somewhere and get captured in. You know, those reservoir species that I pointed out, it'll finally get trapped in one of those and be swept out of the atmosphere. But it's a long-term process. As far as what can we do about all this stuff, some of this stuff was written for a talk I gave in California, so these are a couple of California people on a bunch of bills in the state senate and assembly there. But DuPont will now buy your freons from you. And you can sell them to DuPont if you can capture them. One of the main culprit is car air conditioners, leaky car air conditioners. And when you get them repaired and or dispose of them, the stuff just gets bent into the atmosphere, and there's no incentive right now in the law for the people who fix these things to capture them and recycle them. And there's a couple bills in California that are coming up that will require that, and apparently the only people that the legislators have heard from has been the car air conditioner repair people who think that they're going to lose their jobs because of this, because it is going to be a more expensive process if they have to capture and recycle the freons. It takes some kind of sophisticated equipment to suck this stuff out and capture it. But the point that they're missing is that if they're all required to do that across the board, then nobody's going to get an unfair advantage over his competitors. They'll all be able to pass the costs on to the consumers. Of course, then maybe consumers won't buy car air conditioners anymore. But I kind of doubt that, especially if you've ever been to Sacramento.
Yeah, I was going to say, in fact, it sounds like it might be good for them, because if we all, assuming particularly if you live in a place of part of the country, you could live here without an air conditioner, I assume, but there are places that you couldn't, that if you had, that it would require that you were more careful with your air conditioner, car air conditioner, and some way the repair business for car air conditioning might go up in terms of you replace your hose every
day. Oh, yeah, well, that's true. Yeah. I mean, if you really maintain it properly, you suppose every time you replace it, you'd have to drain the stuff out and capture it and recycle it. So yeah, they could You know, basically, they just need to start a whole new kind of business. Just like electric power utilities are going to have to start whole new kinds of things. Some of them have. They've gotten into conservation and efficiency and solar and things like that. We'll also talk about connection with the greenhouse effect on Wednesday. So this means question whenever you get flexible phones. And I questioned our, I just went to the hose house orientation today. We don't use halons in the fire extinguishers up here. And I also noticed they don't demonstrate them. A lot of places demonstrate them. You know, they give you a train and they just shoot this stuff off. And actually one of the major sources of halons is just oil rigs off, you know, the coast of Britain and various other places where they're drilling for oil out in the ocean. They have these monstrous fire protection systems, and they're just testing them all the time and just blowing this stuff out, these halons out all over the place. And we need to find ways to test these systems without releasing so much of the halons. That's a really hard trick to replace those halons because they are so magically effective in fighting fires. Dry cleaning is another place where CFCs and halons are used. You've got to sort of ask the people who do that for you what they're using. And there are some spray cans, not for aerosols, but for this kind of funny, silly string stuff that still use CFCs as propellants. See, they're used as propellants because, again, they're non-reactive. You don't want something propelling your deodorant under your arm that's going to make your skin turn blue or something from some strange chemistry. So they're very effective in that way. What time is it? I think we go to fire up the
videos.
10 up? Okay, time to fire up the videos. This will be kind of a nice review. And maybe somebody can close the curtains.
Atmospheric gas that protects all forms of life on Earth from most of the sun's damaging radiation. Radiation that can cause skin cancer, eye damage, and suppression of the immune system. The harvesting of fish and plant life are also affected. A vast amount of aquatic life has its beginnings in the oceans near Antarctica. False color imagery of the South Pole from NASA's Nimbus 7 satellite provides scientists with a roadmap of daily changes in the ozone. By tracking this imagery for the past 9 years, they have discovered a trend. Each spring over Antarctica, a hole in the ozone develops, and it has been getting larger year by year. To date, as much as 50 to 60% of the ozone in this area has been lost. These discoveries prompted a coordinated series of Antarctic ozone experiments. Next fall, an international effort, including some 150 scientists and engineers from NASA, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, National Science Foundation, and industry, worked together for 4 months to study this alarming environmental issue. Scientists used ground-based instruments and launched balloon-borne payloads to sample air chemistry at McMurdo Station in Antarctica. At the same time, NASA's DC-3 flying laboratory studied the lower atmosphere, making long missions from Punta Arenas, Chile, into the area of ozone depletion. NASA's high-flying ER-2 plane, carrying a single pilot and a handful of sampling instruments, flew directly into a layer of atmosphere where the ozone was depleted. A number of activities contributing to ozone loss have been pinpointed by the scientific and policy community. No longer do canned aerosol products contain chlorofluorocarbons, or CFCs. but these harmful gases still get into the atmosphere because they are used as refrigerants, fire retardants, foam-blowing agents, and solvents. As long as this persists, ozone will continue to be lost. Initial findings from the Summers Ozone Expedition verify that there is a complex interplay between CFCs, chlorine-containing gases, and the meteorology in certain parts of the world. Ice crystals in the upper atmosphere convert the gases into a byproduct that destroys ozone. These ice crystals usually only form in the atmosphere of the solid pole because it gets so cold. This may explain why other parts of the world are dramatically affected by the depletion. Scientists still do not understand all the mechanisms of change, but thanks to the work of so many, we will soon have a more complete understanding of ozone loss and its threat to the world environment. In the early 1990s, a new generation of atmospheric satellites will probe even further into the problem.